Lee. Okay, now, please be seated. Miss Baker. Mary Baker.
Thank you very much. I'm very honored to be here. I do want to say that as my disabilities have gotten worse since I've gotten older, I have a really hard time reading, writing, and speaking. My written submission is full of grammatical errors and tenses, which I could do when I was younger, and my text is very anecdotal and slightly out of context for other people, but not for me. It seemed logical to me.
Is Ms. Baker's lights on? Excuse me. I'm sorry. Now they're on.
Well,
I apologize for
good.
Interrupting you. Well, let me, since someone else already interrupted you, let me say that in reading your, you need offer no apology. In reading your submission, I was quite moved by its contents.
Really?
So, yes.
I'm either moving somebody or I'm in a lot of trouble.
Well, count me among the moved.
Okay, so I just want to touch on a couple of highlights. There are three things that I wrote that I felt very strongly about, and I mean no disrespect to the court, but I did live in a neighborhood that went really poor, and when I was right down in with all the really super poor people, which I'm like pretty close to that poor myself, I was amazed at some of the stuff that went on for people to survive. And it pretty much consensus is that street justice is quicker, more reliable, and more fair than the civil justice system. And I mean, it's a harsh statement, but I saw that every day. The other thing that really grabbed me was that disrespect for the law then becomes a permanent lifestyle change, that influences the whole family. And then the children, you just can't believe if you see a baby that's 1.5 years old and they have these milestones of comprehension, and all of a sudden they hit like between 18 months and 2 years, and you see the trust completely go out of their eyes because they're living in this criminal world. It's unbelievable. Frequently, children over the age of 11, in street terms, are considered emancipated. Children growing up in this environment of no respect for authority frequently go to school unteachable. Some of these kids cannot do the parallel world. They can't do the legal world and the illegal world. They just can't keep it straight. So they become completely unmanageable. It's just too stressful for them. Okay, so when people go to court and they lose and they are really taking a beating and they give up, there is, after they get done getting their butt whipped, completely losing in court, and they have to go off and lick their wounds and rebuild their lives somehow, a lot of times their only fallback are these long-term poverty people who commit crimes. I mean, this is what happens, and then it becomes permanent. You lose somebody who's able to then go out and have a job. There's two more things I want to say, three actually, about funding. Because I'm not a lawyer, I don't have to worry about whether I understand what's going on or not. Okay, all these big building projects, I understand the building projects like stadiums and stuff like that. That brings in money into the community. It's an investment. But why can't part of the price of that investment be a certain percentage that has to go to provide for legal services to the poor? I mean, it just makes sense. It makes a lot of sense. And trials, if you're going to a county for a trial, I think it's wrong to pick a category like children. I think that you should just have available slots and then let the judges at their discretion pick the most egregious cases. That way you get a better survey, and all counties are different. You know, and not only that, but things fluctuate over time. Right now we're going through a big housing problem, but that could change with time. The other thing that's a really important concept for poor people is that if somebody who's trying to cheat you thinks that you might get a lawyer, that the judge might say, okay, this guy is so crooked, I'm going to give you a lawyer. That makes a person that's trying to cheat the other person hesitate and say, this could cost me $1,500 to cheat this person, or this could cost me $10,000 to cheat this person. So you're going to find that the more poor people that get help or have access to attorneys, the people that are trying to victimize them hold back more and are more willing to work things out because it's going to be more cost effective. Well, so that's the best I got. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. James M. Brennan, President, State Bar of Wisconsin.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I'm here in my capacity as President of the State Bar, but I also don't forget my other duties as a public interest lawyer over the last 30 years plus. I've litigated right-to-counsel cases. As a lawyer, I've accepted court appointments as special counsel, guardian ad litem, and appointed counsel for indigent. But I'm here today because, as we've heard somewhat this morning, the question of appointment of counsel and right to counsel is something that seems to be foreign to us. It's not unusual that we would hear, as we did this morning, that if we want to learn a little bit more about appointment of counsel, we have to go where the rule of law has extended from America and England to places like India and Pakistan. And that here it's somewhat of an exotic question. The appointment of counsel is a fundamental judicial act. I am of an age, and some of you may be, when we recall that the setting of bail and the appointment of counsel was a routine criminal matter, that the judiciary made appointments of counsel as they needed, but before the federal mandates of Gideon versus Wainwright and Argersinger versus Hamlin, they did it really on a case-by-case basis, applying a variety of factors, not unlike some of the factors in the petition today. One of the good things about the State Public Defenders Program is that it extended statewide counsel to indigents in certain federally mandated cases. The downside is that it removed the appointment of counsel from the judicial branch and moved it to the executive branch. As such, in my opinion, the appointment of counsel has become somewhat of a lost art among the judiciary. And we're here today in part, the State Bar is here today, interested in making this a real part of our response to our joint response in the judicial branch to the access to justice problem. The State Bar, as you've heard, has taken many positions on appointment of counsel. We've supported the inherent authority, basically the Joni B. type authority, for many years. We're interested in our circuit court judges that in questions of what type of case do I have, we want circuit court judges to ask the question, what do I need to afford due process to these litigants before me? This is not something for the clerk to do. This is not something for even the legal clinics to do. This is something for a court to struggle with, as they did really historically. From not long after our Magna Carta and through much of English history, appointment of counsel, very clearly a judicial, fundamental judicial role. Equal justice under law does have implicit and embedded in it the notion that, you know, an impartial judge and dynamic lawyers, the fundamentals of litigation, are what due process is all about and what equal justice is all about. So it somewhat disappoints me when I have to come to find that we must go to India to find out what that means for us. State Bar is interested in a dynamic litigation system. We have an adversary system. We have judges. We want to be judges, not to be helpers, not to be mediators, not to inject themselves in any way other than judging on an impartial basis. We also recognize, in order for judges to do just that, it's an adversary system. There needs to be some fundamental dynamics in that adversary system to allow it to work. So the State Bar's position on this petition is that, in principle, it's been the Bar's position all along that you as a circuit court judge, you as a trial judge, have to ask the question, what processes do in this matter before me, and how will I discharge that? You, of course, if you're a circuit court judge, you can run what amounts to a default calendar and run everything through. But we want our judges, frankly, to struggle somewhat with what process is due to the litigants before me in this case, be it the complexity of the case, the legal issues involved, be it the nature of the particular litigant. We heard about cognitive issues, language issues, incarcerated status, whole host of obstacles that a court should decide. And part of this remedy for that, in terms of what processes do in this case, is appointment of counsel in many cases. Very clearly, the court has the inherent authority to do so. State Bar supports the exercise of that authority to do so. It is part, not all, but part of the access to justice situation. It's something that the judges can indeed do. In fact, we believe have a responsibility to do for more litigants than they're aware. Again, because in our opinion, this has become somewhat of a lost art. Too many circuit court judges have said, the legislature hasn't said I can do this. The fundamental appointment of counsel is just inheres in your role as judges and in your supervisory authority over the justice system. So we are here to, number one, encourage the court to adopt a appointment of counsel role for circuit court judges. We at the State Bar were somewhat confused, as you were, as to, is this a mandate in the first paragraph? Is it discretionary in the second paragraph? And that's the reason for which we've taken a neutral stand. What we are not neutral about is your obligation to appoint attorneys in cases that, not yours, but trial court's obligations to appoint attorneys in many more and different kinds of cases and for many more and different types of litigants than just those charged with a felony or misdemeanor and those whose standards fall below whatever the current state public defender's standards are.
Counsel?
Yes.
If I may. Fundamental to the courts is a concept of due process. Fundamental to our consideration is inherent authority. I want to bring it down to Shawano County, Wisconsin. And we can issue some kind of rule or directive or something. But what does it do to the judge in Shawano County? How does the judge play this out? He's dealing with a very real county board right downstairs or right down the hall. And so he has something from the Supreme Court, but is he being set up? Is he being protected? Is there, I don't want to say cover, I don't mean to suggest they're not going to be doing their jobs, but there are the issues of funding and local dynamics that also concern me. Maybe they shouldn't, but they do. So how do you deal with that? How do you put something together that...
First of all,
takes that into consideration.
First of all, this is exactly why the court has to take the lead. It's one thing if you're in a county like Milwaukee County, 50 lawyers, if I want to appoint a lawyer in a court, have a circuit court and judge in Milwaukee County, there's no exposure there. I can actually do the right thing. If you're in that one county judge, a one county court, you have a much different, you're far more exposed, each and every one of your decisions. And for what's the cost to the county of this decision, and I appreciate that, that's precisely why this court has to give the circuit court judges adequate education to make the right sort of compelling record, and adequate, frankly, cover to do the right thing. And certainly state bar lawyers and advocates are willing to support by way of advocacy those sorts of initiatives. But I do recognize that it's a huge political problem. We have our courts funded in part by the county and in part by the state. And so long as there's that sort of bifurcated funding, it will really require a lot more collaborative efforts to get funding for the judicial system as a whole, including all the functions within that system, including an appointment of counsel function funding. And frankly, what we're doing at the state bar and the criminal side is we've pulled together the county folks, we've pulled together the clerks, the judges, the defenders, the prosecutors. We've pulled together those who have a piece of state funding. And instead of simply allowing the budget process to proceed without any sort of coordination or collaboration, we've essentially agreed to work to fund the system as a whole, not view zero-sum games between various parts of the criminal justice system. And we actually feel we'll have a very effective stance with respect to the legislature. That same sort of thing really has to be done, seems to me, on the civil side as well. You know, we do have to have a collaborative approach to these things. It's really not just the bench, the bar, the public. We have to put together a sort of an approach to the legislative and executive branch that really does provide some robust advocacy across the state and in all systems for what we need to make the system work. And frankly, one of the things we need to make the system work is more lawyers handling people who need help in complicated cases to permit the courts to do their job. And so, I mean, I would certainly look forward to an opportunity to essentially fully fund the judicial branch of government. But that funding does include a notion that lawyers do help. They're a central part. It's not merely pro bono. We're not going to be able to do it by engaging in unbundled legal services or courthouse clinics or more information or what have you. We have to have a comprehensive and systemic look that is mutually supportive of all the functions. Now, and as I swore an oath to assist the court in doing this, but this frankly means telling the court that we're all in the same boat. We'll either hang together or we'll surely hang separately if we don't address funding issues jointly. So, you know, we're certainly willing to work either with county associations or the state. Ultimately, this is a big enough picture. This is a big enough package to be, in my opinion, to be something funded at the state level rather than county by county. And I do think you would probably ultimately find support among the counties association to do just that. You know, we probably do need a statewide type system rather than a county by county system.
So do you envision, like, there's a state public defender's office, there would be a state civil defender's office?
It's certainly something to think about. It is certainly something in terms of, we're a little ahead of ourselves on a model, and there's some excellent providers out there doing work cutting across the state. But it's not a leap to say if we're going to take a whole new category of cases and provide attorneys with them, and state's going to have some funding over it, that the state is likely to want to have some statewide component.
Where's the state's incentive to do this if we do this today and the counties have to fund it?
Pardon me?
Where's the state's incentive to create that kind of office if today we say we adopt this plan, counties, you bear the burden because that's all we can do?
Frankly, yeah, and at present, the states are going to say, you know, funding the justice system is a blended thing, but appointment of counsel is the county. We've only taken the public defender's piece of it and the prosecutor's piece of it and put it on the state area. There's some other funding for some GAL work and what have you. The political pressure comes when there are sufficient numbers of appointments so that the actual, this sort of cost is actually difficult for a county to bear. And frankly, that's what drove the creation of the State Public Defenders Program in the first instance, was that this could be done better on a statewide model rather than a patchwork of counties. And it was only after major Supreme Court decisions held rights to counsel as matters of federal constitutional law that these large categories of cases were presented to the counties, worked their way through. The counties very quickly felt that they couldn't handle it. So ultimately, in my opinion, it would be a statewide type program. In fact, the state bar's position calls for general purpose funding statewide for all functions of the court system, including the appointment of counsel. So to the extent that we have a position on that, it said it should be a statewide funded, and it's systematic. So I realize that's a little long, but that's where I'm at.
Are there any further questions, Mr. Brennan? Your red light's on.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mark Wadium? Is it Wadium or Wadium? Wadium. Outagamie County lobbyist, Mr. Wadium.
Good afternoon, Justices. This petition, the way it's written, is an unfunded mandate on counties and on the county property taxpayer. Just to give you a little local flavor, the property taxpayers of Outagamie County already contribute, and this is our from our 2011 budget. We run calendar year budgets. $3,290,606 of property tax levy into the court system, and that's funding the clerk of courts, circuit court, court commissioner, the district attorney's office, family court commissioner, and the family court program. The fiscal projection for this would cost the Outagamie County property taxpayers $1,680,000 a year. And that's based on our 08 census numbers, so that's probably low. We do not have the legal authority to raise property taxes to pay for this. So that means my board would have the unenviable position of finding out who to cut. So the very groups that this would help would suffer. Someone had suggested that county spending, there's a lot of money in there that could be switched around. Well, I would disagree. A lot of county spending is determined by other units of government. We operate under multitudes of state and federal mandates. We do some programs that may not be individually mandated, but that's because the board has looked at these programs and determined they save money in mandated areas. And I would point out juvenile corrections is one of those areas. This last state budget, the county got less help from the state. Our funding levels were cut across the board. And if people are interested, we're still working on trying to fix child support enforcement, hopefully deal with the family care cap, and the federal government is just handing us a cut to the county nursing home that's coming October 1st. The way this is written, this will fall on the backs of the counties, and we would respectfully request that you do not do this to us at this time. And I'll address any questions I can.
Thank you. Any questions?
Okay, what's Plan D? By that I mean, what kind of alternatives are there, do you think? If we're torn between some kind a constitutional directive that due process means a fair proceeding, and there's concerns that these are not fair in some instances, what's the court to do? Any ideas? I don't expect you to have the answer, but any ideas? If you were drawing a plan.
Well, the legislature is the one that controls the purse strings. That's the direction that the petitioners need to go. I mean, that's the direction I go when I'm charged with trying to help the county fund its programs and pay its bills that we're directed to by others. So I think that's where the petitioners need to go, is go lobby the court, or sorry, go lobby the legislature to fund the court. I mean, we've worked for years, decades, on trying to get proper funding for the state public defender's office. And that was passed last session to increase the numbers of state public defenders, and this session it was funded. And hopefully we won't be back too soon to address that again, but odds are we will, because it wasn't a perfect funding solution.
Well, they fixed the indigency at, what, 2011?
That's correct.
Therefore, if it gets worse, you've got a problem.
Yes, ma'am. Absolutely.
Well, you can't resolve it, but I keep thinking that it must have cost the states and school boards a lot of money for Plessy v. Ferguson to make them equal, separate but equal. I mean, I don't know that that was ever done or they figured it out. And then when Brown v. Board of Education came, which money and most people think that was a correct and very significant decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, it must have cost school boards a lot of money to handle that, as well as dislocation of families and schools. So what's the obligation, and a rhetorical question, but of the court to take what would under the law, or some will argue, is a principal position versus the principal, meaning the money? It seems to me that's one of the issues the court faces.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to appear on this matter? Hearing none, Mr. Ebbett, you have a few minutes to close this.
Thank you, Madam. I would propose to address a few points that have been raised throughout the day, and then just a short summation if the court has the patience for this. First of all, this morning, I believe you, Madam Chief Justice, made the point that this rule does not change the power of judges. That's correct. It does not change the power of judges, but it does require them to exercise their discretion, as the appellate court did in Zena X DC after Joni B. The trial court did not even exercise its discretion. The appellate court found that it was appropriate that it order the trial court to exercise its discretion. So that is one of the functions of this petition.
So it's a clarification of somebody. I guess Judge Yamahiro said the word I was looking for was not expand the power, but clarify it.
It's a clarification, and I called it an adaptation of the Joni B. to the rest of the system. The second point is that Marcia Mansfield was exactly correct in her description of the array of legal services that exist. Assisted pro se does help. Pro bono does help. Courthouse centers do help. She's exactly right. And she's right that she didn't say this, but there's essentially a big donut hole in the middle, which is the need for appointed attorneys. And the need for appointed attorneys is not dismissive of the value of these other efforts. We need all of them in a system. She's also correct in her, probably the question should have been asked of me rather than her, but she did a good job of discussing what the rule does and is intended to do. It is intended as a mandate to trial courts, but it's intended as a mandate for them to exercise their discretion using as suggested factors, the factors in the proposed rule.
Counsel, what's the where does the 200% come from?
That comes from an attempt to include more of the working poor in this benefit. We don't like to say, well, you're just not quite poor enough to benefit from this. You need to be a little bit poorer than you already are. There are a lot of – this point was raised actually by the Milwaukee County Board Chairman saying, well, the very poor get counsel, the very rich get counsel. What about the lower middle class and the working poor? That's what this is. Obviously, the cost is going to be reduced if you drop eligibility to 125% or 100% of poverty. Justice Bradley, in terms of your question about there are a lot of cases where these basic human needs are involved, and does this mean an attorney for every single case? I don't think that it does. I think that the only experience and data that we have now, first of all, there's no way to know how many cases, what percentage of cases. There's no way to know, and we've said that when we estimated the cost. But the experience and the data that we have are our legal actions data from my point of view. And I use this 14% in the memorandum because, to a certain extent, we've done this kind of screening. We've evaluated the interest at stake, the basic human need at stake, whether there's counsel on the other side, whether the case is complex. Those difficult ones are the ones that we take. So it's not exact, but the 14% is a rough approximation. And then even with our data, about 5.5% are uncontested cases. My guess is that not many trial courts are going to appoint counsel in an uncontested case. Some cases that are uncontested, but not many. And so if you take that away from our 14%, you get about, of the universe of legal issues that our clients have, you get about 8.5%.
Mr. Abbott, was there some mention earlier today about an amendment to the rule?
Yes.
In regard to consideration of whether or not there's counsel on the other side?
Yes. My most recent written comments responded to the Coalition for the Civil Right to Counsel suggestion that added to those factors be whether they said opposing party, my language would be other parties in the litigation are represented. I've encountered hostile guardians ad litem where I think that the parent needed counsel. Just a point, there was a discussion about what court staff can do. The rule is SCR 70.41. There's a section in that, subsection 5, called Unauthorized Information and Assistance. Court staff may not do any of the following. There are 17 things court staff may not do. One of them is apply the law to the facts of a given case or give directions regarding how an individual should respond or behave in any aspect of the legal process. Nothing. There's also a prohibition. Court staff may not fill in a form. May not fill in a form unless required by subsection 4H, which is the Americans with Disabilities Act. So there's really very – the help that people need, what do I do? What am I supposed to do in this case is not available from court staff. I would just like to point out that I understand the counties are going to come up as they have and say, we can't afford it. We don't have the money. What I tried to point out this morning and what I've heard is they only talk about human services cuts. And they say, we're going to hurt the very people we're trying to benefit. They don't mention the sheriff's department. They don't mention roads. They don't mention all of the other areas in the county budget. Because of the budget crunch in Milwaukee, the county executive just took a fair amount of money out of the sheriff's department. That's where he got the money. And the sheriff's department My memory may not be exact, but I think the budget was around $150 million in Milwaukee for the Sheriff's Department. Milwaukee has a police department, and so do all of the other municipalities. So I'm just, my point is just that I don't hear the county saying, well, if we do this, we're going to have to take money from the sheriffs or from the roads. It's always, we're going to have to take money from human services, kids, old people, the very people that these petitioners are trying to benefit. It's the duty of the county board to figure this out. It's not the duty of the judge to figure this out. I understand why the judge and this court want to be sensitive to the funding situations of counties. But when there's a public necessity, and that's the question here, when there's a public necessity that a governmental body at whatever level has to fund, it's the duty of that legislature to decide how to do it. And I have a number of suggestions, but it's not the circuit court's duty, and it's not this court's duty to figure out whether counties can afford it. The tripartite system of government and checks and balances, I don't think, will work that way. My view in terms of the Shawano County example, I understand county executive and the county board supervisors down the hall in the courthouse, but if the county has been makes it so that the court can't operate as a court, the court cannot do justice, then I don't know why I ran for judge and why I'm a judge if I'm going to say, well, I know that that I can make these appointments and really do justice, but I don't want to even have that power because the county board is going to get mad at me and if I appoint counsel. I don't know why I'm sitting on that bench if I if I'm so concerned about the affordability on the part of the county that I can't appoint counsel in an obviously critical situation. I would like, Justice Bradley, you raised a point about the Joni B. Basis. I think that there are two primary bases of that decision. One is obviously the inherent power of the courts or the separation of powers, and that goes to the need of the court, not the need of litigants. That consideration is what does the court need to operate as a court? And there are decisions of this court that have said it's long been recognized that the courts have the power to operate as courts just because they're courts. That's what the inherent power goes to. That's what the separation of power goes to. And the need of the court, of the circuit court, is not just for speed and expedition of cases. It's to do justice. And Joni B. articulated that on page 11. It said the court's need for the orderly and fair presentation of the case. Even if there's no due process clause anywhere, there's still a need for the orderly and fair presentation of the case. The need is that of the court, not the litigants. Then the second part of Joni B. is a due process. It's separate and apart from the inherent power. It's the due process. And I read two levels of due process in that opinion. One is systemic due process. There is a pronouncement in Joni B. that indicates that due process requires that courts be free to make case-by-case determinations as to whether counsel is necessary. And I quoted that in my recent written comments, but there's language that goes to the system level. It's a denial of due process when courts are prohibited from deciding what's fair in individual cases. And this approach of Joni B.'s is supported in Lassiter prior to Joni B. and in Turner at this point. Then once the judges have the ability to make a case-by-case determination, then the trial court judge, in terms of due process, can either make a due process determination, as was done in Joni B., the hypothetical in that case, after that hypothetical was given, the question was asked in the opinion, how can this process possibly be fair, or how can this trial possibly be fair? So you can formulate due process that way as the judge. I'm saying, how can this possibly be fair, or if the judge wants to, the judge can utilize Matthews versus Eldridge balancing test. So that's a little more express. The judge can use either one. And if Matthews is used, the criteria in the second part of our proposed rule, those go to the risk of erroneous deprivation part of Matthews. The interest at stake in the first paragraph of the rule, they go to the interest of the litigant. That's that part of the Matthews. What's the interest of the private litigant? That's the first shelter, sustenance, children, so on. They go to that first part. But the second array of criteria in the rule go to the risk of erroneous deprivation. So that's what the circuit judge uses to say, how can this possibly be fair, to use the Joni B language. And then and there's a survey in terms of the risk of erroneous deprivation. There's a recent survey that shows pro se litigants have greater difficulty not only in understanding and applying the points of substantive and evidentiary law, but even in conceptualizing the key claims or defenses of their cases. So when you have a pro se litigant, there's a problem with them even being able to conceptualize, which I had the same problem when I just got out of law school, but I hopefully ironed it out. And then there's the government interest part of Matthews, to me, is to a large extent the same as the private litigant. I mean, both government and private litigant have an interest in a non-erroneous deprivation of home or sustenance or children or safety. So the other authority I think this goes to whether we're really going to have a tripartite system of government, whether the judicial branch is strong and independent or weak and dependent. And it looks to me like the legislative branch has been right along acting in a way that weakens and makes more dependent the judiciary. I mean, as I understand it, you have to lapse $17 million a year. So there's less and less appropriation, and there's more and more lapsing. And the way that the legislature is controlling the purse strings, and not only for our judicial system, but around the country, courts are getting weaker and less. They're getting more dependent. And that's where the constitutional power of this court is important. In State v. Holmes, this court said, thus the Constitution grants the Supreme Court power to adopt measures necessary for the due administration of justice in the state. Due administration of justice, and that's repeated in a number of this court's cases, including assuring litigants a fair trial. So that's a constitutional power that the courts have. And this is an opportunity to exercise that power, maintain the strength and the independence of the judiciary. It takes courage to do this, but what I would ask is that this court adopt the rule, and if the court wants to implement it in stages, I think that's fine, but I would ask that there be no delay in adopting the rule.
Well, how do you view it as being implemented in stages?
Pardon, I didn't hear the first part.
I'm sorry. How do you envision this being implemented in stages?
Well, I'd like to say that's in the discretion of this court. I mean, I don't want it implemented in stages. I think there's a crying need right now to adopt the rule and then start implementing it in all cases. But Justice Rogensack has suggested one possibility. There's been a suggestion about pilot projects. So those are possible forms of staged implementation. But I think the rule should be adopted first. And you know, the idea that the petitioner should go to the legislature. First of all, if we look to the legislature rather than the counties, this court's going to say, well, we have a separation of powers problem. We cannot command the legislature to fund this. Then, as the last speaker for Outagamie County said, for the petitioners to go to the legislature, I mean, that's fine in theory, But we've gone to the legislature, worked extremely hard, got $1 million, got $2.5 million, and now we got $0. And so that's just not a realistic suggestion. I think the action has to be here, and I'd request immediate adoption of the rule.
Assuming that the court adopts a principle that is espoused here, that the trial court has inherent power to make appointments in civil litigation for the indigents in the following kinds of cases, that the trial court should use its discretion in appointing counsel, something like that. That's the principle that I understand.
Correct.
Is in this rule, right?
Correct.
Okay. So we still have issues, maybe, of implementation, if I understand you. One, what kind of form should be used for indigency, although we have forms in other areas for indigency, right? Another form might be explain why this case fits within the human rights categories, right? Do you foresee that the court would adopt these kinds of what I would call administrative implementations?
Well, it could. I have a form in my latest written submission. My idea is that this should be as simple as possible to administer. The form that I submitted is an attempt at simplicity. Whether it covers everything, I don't know. Then there's the – I also submitted the income guidelines for 200% of poverty or under that a judge could have on the bench. Mm-hmm. I think if counsel is denied, there should be a statement of reasons on the record as is required in so many other – with regard to so many other decisions. So I don't know that needs a lot of –
raises the question, suppose counsel is appointed and the county objects on the money ground or whatever ground. Is it a right of appeal? Is it an interlocutory appeal?
Well, I think there's a right of appeal. My experience with interlocutory appeals is that that's not a big worry because we can hardly ever get them. So I don't think there are going to be many decisions like that where an interlocutory appeal is granted. But yes, can be appealed if the county doesn't pay. Then I think we've got Romasco and Lehman and Chiarcus that indicate the court can order the county to pay, and the county has to pay.
What about if the judges talk to their county boards, and they know the counties don't have any money, and we tell them, well, you have the inherent authority, and you should exercise it. But it's a discretionary decision on their part, so they just don't exercise it.
I would appeal that one for the pro se litigant. I don't think that's a legitimate basis for not appointing counsel.
The trial judge may say a number of other things along with it, but you would agree with him, wouldn't you, that it's discretionary on whether they're going to exercise their authority?
Well, it's discretionary, but it has to be a reasonable exercise of discretion, and I don't think saying the county doesn't have the money. I mean, in terms of the hypothetical or the premise of the question, I don't know how the judge knows whether the county has money because I...
No, I was just... judges talk to the county boards because they need a lot of stuff from the county board. So there, many judges talk to them on a very regular basis, some less often than others. But certainly in the smaller counties, the judges usually work very closely with the county boards because they're supposed to be on the same team, sort of. And they may not say at a hearing that the county doesn't have any money, so I'm not going to do this, but they may have 10 people that ask for assistance, and they may not find that it's appropriate in this particular case. It's not serious enough. There's not counsel on the other side. There's not a variety of things, and so I'm not going to appoint counsel. But, in the back of their mind,
they're going to know what they know, just like everybody knows what they know. And if they don't think that there's enough money and they don't appoint counsel, then where are we?
Well, they may be able to do that. I mean,
Only Milwaukee County is proceeding on Joni B. and routinely appointing counsel in CHIPS cases.
And that's one reason for the petition. Mm-hmm. Nobody's doing it.
Right,
right. And they may be able to do that, mm-hmm. and it may be rare that we come along and appeal a denial, but if the reasons that they give, it's not that complex, pretty straightforward. I mean, that was given by the trial judge in Piper versus Pop, and I really disagree with that. But you can, if you give a reason as to why, and it's legitimate, then fine. But if you give reasons that really aren't accurate, even in your own mind, and you're doing it because you don't want to endanger the county treasury, then it's a miscarriage of justice. If we found out about it, we'd appeal it because it's not a reasonable exercise of discretion. So I understand that could happen, and I understand why a judge would be inclined to do it, but I don't think that's proper for a judge to do that.
I'm not saying it's proper or improper. I was just kind of looking at the practicalities, given the experience that we've had with Joni B. And, you know, your office isn't going to know about everything that goes on because who's going to appeal it? You're going to have an unrepresented person that wants counsel. Judge says no. So what do? They just chug on. They don't have somebody to appeal.
That's why I call it a modest proposal, and that's why shall is in it. But it is a modest proposal because this can happen, and I'm concerned. But I also think there are enough judges that are going to be if this rule is promulgated, that they're going to look at these factors and appoint counsel where they think counsel ought to be appointed. And whatever the word is that you want to use, it does give them a basis for doing so. They can say the Supreme Court has required that we do this.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Are there any other questions?
Justice
Prosser.
Is it your representation that in the 71 counties outside of Milwaukee that attorneys are not being appointed for either of the parents in CHIPS cases?
No, that's not my representation. I thought I heard one or two of the judges this morning say it's their information that it rarely happens outside Milwaukee County. But I don't have data on how often in CHIPS cases. The Xena XDC case was a failure to a and I think that was Winnebago County, where the trial court didn't appoint. So I know about that case, and the Court of Appeals said you have to exercise your discretion. But I'm not making any representation about the other 71 counties. I'm sure that on occasion that happens. I mean, the Josias versus Josias case was Milwaukee, but they're the trial court appointed counsel, and the Court of Appeals said that there's no statutory requirement, therefore it was an erroneous exercise of discretion. So you have the Court of Appeals that doesn't know that there's an error power to appoint. But in answer to your question, I can't give you data on the other 71 in CHIPS cases. I suspect sometimes it happens pursuant to Joni B.
Are there any other questions of Ms. Abbott?
Mr. Abbott, on
behalf of the court, I want to thank you for the petition and for the memorandum in support of the rule petition. You gave the court an enormous amount of information, and it's very well annotated as to prior case law and separation of powers and inherent powers. So, it has been very helpful to the courts, and I want to thank all the people who have come to the court today and spent a considerable amount of time with us on a very important issue that is not only significant in Wisconsin, but across the country.
Well, I'd like to thank the court for its attention and its enormous patience with regard to this. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Abbott. It's a 5:10. I've checked the agenda. There's nothing here that I think we can handle in the 20 minutes before our ending hour. But before we discuss that, I'll close the hearing on Rules Petition 10-08, Petition to Establish a Right to Counsel in Civil cases. Anyone want to come back in 5 minutes and deal with 15 minutes